know, it would be great to have this crystal ball, but I did inspections on the Kullock. But we did not do inspections on the Ivic.
The Coast Guard inquiry into the grounding of the Kullock wraps up. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state kills nearly 90 bears in its first predator control program for the species.
Hopefully that's going to give a kickstart to the moose population, which will provide more moose for the area and more moose for hunters.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com, and by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The U.S. Coast Guard is expected to wrap up its inquiry today into what went wrong when the Shell drill rig Kullock broke free of its tow line and ran aground in late December. This afternoon, Coast Guard Marine Casualty Investigator Keith Fawcett questioned Captain John Skoglund, the master of the tugboat Ivic, which had been towing the drill rig.
What's your understanding of your responsibility for the vessel you're towing, in this case, the Kullock?
Bottom line, as I've always been taught, as far as the Coast Guard is concerned, I'm responsible for my vessel and the vessel I'm connected to while under tow. Of course, I'm sure everyone's read the tow plan, and the tow plan is written differently. The towmaster is responsible in the tow plan as I read it.
And how can that be? I mean, you're actually doing the towing operation, and the towmaster is standing on a vessel that has no propulsion system.
By the plan, I take orders from the towmaster, sir.
Skoglund told investigators that the tow plan for the Kullock required the ship to stay within 200 miles of land because that is the range of Coast Guard search and rescue helicopters. At one point, Skoglund worried about incoming rough weather and requested a change of course, but was refused permission from his superiors. Skoglund told the panel that after the Kullock broke free, a number of ships responded to the emergency. Eventually, two tugs got emergency lines on the Kullock, but it was difficult to pinpoint who exactly was in charge of the task. Yesterday, the federal on-scene coordinator of the Kullock grounding incident testified to investigators that before the rig departed, he was confident that Shell was doing a good job. Coast Guard Captain Paul Mailer said he wished he would have taken a closer look at the tug that was to tow the rig. APRN Steve Heimel reports.
Tows are routine, Captain Mailer said, and there is no requirement for any Coast Guard inspection. By the time Shell sought to leave Dutch Harbor, with its new heavy tug, the Ivic, pulling the bulky rig, Mailer, as commander of the waters of Western Alaska, had dealt with the company enough that he was confident they were responsible.
I was convinced of Shell's commitment to doing this safely.
What Mailer did not know was that the Ivic had already had an electrical failure, but he had been briefed on the plan for towing the rig, and Shell had responded to his concerns about the safety of having the full crew aboard and had reduced that crew to a minimum. And he had sent an inspector to Dutch Harbor, but one thing he did not do was order an inspection of the Ivic. He told the investigating panel he now wishes he had.
You know, it would be great to have this crystal ball, but I did inspections on the Kullock. But we did not do inspections on the Ivic. So if I could go back and do it over, if I had known where we were going, I would have ordered an inspection on the Ivic also.
The story from there is well known. The towing connection broke for unknown reasons in the big swells of the Gulf of Alaska, and the Ivic's four engines failed. Mailer said the Coast Guard stood up a team as soon as it was reported. Other vessels arrived. Tow lines were reestablished but repeatedly parted, and the rig was drifting toward Kodiak Island. The tensest moment came during the long night of December 28th and 29th, when rescue helicopters found the rig was tossing around too much and returned to Kodiak without rescuing the crew.
That was one of the scariest points of this response for me.
When daylight came, the helicopters returned and were able to remove the 18 crew members. Mailer described to the panel why four people were dropped back onto the drilling rig after that. It was to try to get a better tow line attachment. Multiple tugs had tried, but Mailer said nobody knew which line was the best one to try to retrieve.
We have multiple lines hanging off the Kulik. Some are in various condition, and we do not have a good understanding of which line would be secure to get hold of.
So four salvage experts were dropped onto the tossing disc-shaped rig, but they were unable to do much and were quickly lifted off. With one remaining tug, the Alert, straining its engines and unable to stop the drift, Mailer said the time came for him to use his authority to take charge of the unified command.
That I went to the front of the room and I got everyone's attention. I said, listen up. And I went through the scenario. This is where it's at right now. These are the weather conditions. We are getting to the point now of concern for the safety of the crew of Alert.
The noisy room went dead silent. Mailer said everybody felt they'd failed, but that's not the way he looks at it. They had to cut the line. Mailer used the word heroic to describe the performance of the four salvage workers and called the helicopter pilots the best the Coast Guard has. Responding to a question from one of the lawyers at the hearing, the commander said those success stories needed to be told.
When we left this, after everything was said and done and we stood down in unified command, I can honestly say we did everything we could, and I was pretty darn proud of the response that went forward.
Mailer's testimony is now finished, and the panel of Coast Guard investigators, along with other agencies, are nearing the end of their fact gathering. And that will be followed by a report to 17th District Commander Admiral Thomas Ostebo. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game took 89 bears this month as part of a predator control program approved by the Board of Game last year. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the efforts are meant to encourage the growth of a struggling moose population in southwest Alaska.
Hunting for moose in much of Game Management 19A, which includes villages like Kalskag, Aniak, and Sleetmoot, has been closed since 2005 because of a decline in the population. Fish and Game wildlife biologist and spokesperson Kathy Harms says moose numbers are down because of heavy predation.
This year, the department conducted a bear control program. We ended up taking 89 bears in a very small, about 500 square mile area. And hopefully that's going to give a kickstart to the moose population, which will provide more moose for the area and more moose for hunters.
But other biologists in the state disagree with the program. Vic Van Ballenberg has studied moose and wolves in Alaska for nearly four decades.
This, to my knowledge, is the first time that Department of Fish and Game biologists have shot bears from helicopters as part of a control program. It's a pretty extreme measure, and it's even more extreme when the goal was to remove virtually every bear from that area.
The Board of Game agreed to create the bear control focus area south of the Kuskokwim River for 2 years at the request of local hunters and the area's Fish and Game Advisory Committee. Fish and Game's Kathy Harms says removal of the bears will have negligible effects on the overall game management unit, which is 20 times larger than the control focus area.
It is so small, we expect bears to migrate in, and within probably 4 years, completely re-inhabit all the bear habitat at similar densities. The difference is, by giving a 2-year relief from predation for the moose population can take a step up and be able to handle more predation for a longer period.
But Vic Van Ballenberg doesn't think the right information was used to establish the control area.
In this case, I do not think that there was adequate field work done prior to approving the control program to actually link bear predation to poor moose calf survival.
This year's bear control program is in addition to one for wolves that's been in effect since 2004. Kathy Harms says wolf control hasn't worked in favor of moose in the region. She says other management strategies weren't an option.
It's particularly challenging because bear densities are high throughout a lot of the interior. There aren't a lot of places that we can put bears. In terms of other types of programs, we looked at diversionary feeding of bears during calving season, where we provide other things for them to eat. That's prohibitively expensive, far more than what we could afford to do.
The department will cull more bears next spring. Meat harvested as part of the program was donated to 8 nearby villages. Bear hides will be sold at auction. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Galena resident describes her decision to evacuate the community.
It was getting really scary. I thought I could stay through it, but after a while, I didn't want to.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Floodwaters are subsiding at Galena after an ice jam on the Yukon River broke up last night. State Emergency Operations Center Chief Mark Roberts says the blockage began giving way around 8 p.m. The state isn't expecting major flooding in the downriver communities of Koyukuk and Nulato. Roberts says conditions are looking better than previously feared because of the way the ice and water are moving.
Been able to escape the Yukon in some places and flow out into other areas, so it's kind of taken out some of the surge. Plus, it hasn't released completely all at once, and the ice chunks are moving slower. The ice, so it's kind of slowed things down, so the surge is not as great as it could have been.
Government response teams members and about 70 Galena locals who refused to evacuate are watching the community emerge from the Yukon. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum surveyed conditions last night after the ice jam released.
It was pretty impressive from the air because all this water that is probably about 20 miles wide pouring back over the riverbank.
The river remained over the bank at Galena today, but receded from higher spots, leaving behind ice blocks and a big mess. Roberts says an emergency response team is mobilizing to support Galena residents so recovery work can begin. The incident management team is working with Galena's city manager and the tribal chief to get power, potable water, and sewer systems in the airport area functioning so it can be used as a base of operations. Galena residents who evacuated are anxious to get back to the community to survey the damage. APRN's Annie Feit spoke with one resident who has been through several floods over many decades but can't remember any as devastating as this one.
Alberta Summer thought she would be able to wait out the flood in Galena, but she started to change her mind Tuesday afternoon.
That's when the water really started raising. It rose 2 feet in 1 hour, and that's when we knew we had to move out of the house because I could tell it was starting to go into the house.
Her greenhouse was floating away, and the wooden shed in her submerged yard was tipping over. Initially, Summer and her husband moved onto their houseboat. They parked in a safer spot in the trees where there wasn't as much ice floating past. Still, she says it was a frightening scene.
When I saw that ice going through Alexander's Lake, it was just crushing all those spruce trees, just knocking them down. It was just at full force, and it was so fast. It got really scary, and I thought, God, I could be here for a couple of more weeks, or I didn't know how long it was going to last.
So Summer boated to the airport. It was an eerie trip through town.
When I was going through, I didn't even recognize the place. I tried to look really quick to see whose houses I saw, but it was very unrecognizable.
On Tuesday night, Summer took an Air National Guard C-130 flight to Fairbanks, where she's now staying with her daughter. Summer has lived in Galena since she was around 10 years old in 1963. She can remember three big floods in town since then, but none that were so widespread or caused so much damage. She doesn't have flood insurance and expects the same is probably true of many of her neighbors.
The last time we flooded was 21 years ago. I used to get flood insurance before, then I quit. I know of maybe a couple of people that may have got flood insurance. After we flooded in 92, we got it for quite a few years, and then I think maybe we got too comfortable. that we were okay. But normally when it flooded, usually don't flood up toward our place. This is the first time.
Summer spent part of the morning at the Fairbanks airport trying to get a flight back to Galena. She says she's anxious to see how badly damaged her house is. But for now, no commercial flights are going to Galena, and the only people flying to the community are those helping with the immediate recovery. So Summer will have to wait it out in Fairbanks a while longer. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The National Weather Service issued a red flag warning for portions of South Central Alaska today, and burn bans are going into effect around the state. KSKA's Dacia Eaton has more.
Anchorage Fire Department officials say the fire danger is extreme in South Central, and they're asking residents to refrain from burning outdoors. John C., an AFD forester, says a late spring is the reason.
Normally by this time, our grasses have greened up. We're still in a situation where most of our grasses are still cured and very burnable. So until things green up, we're going to be living with this elevated high fire danger and the risk of an ember, a spark from a campfire or barbecue grill igniting a fire near one of our homes.
In addition, forecasters predict winds will pick up along Turnagain Arm and portions of the hillside. The Anchorage Fire Department has suspended all burning permits throughout the municipality as of Thursday. C says there have already been half a dozen small fires throughout Anchorage this week, all less than an acre. Maggie Rogers is with the Alaska Division of Forestry in Fairbanks. She says fire danger is also high for the interior and in the Matanuska Valley.
We do have red flag warnings for a significant portion of kind of the interior of Alaska for lower humidities. And then closer to Anchorage for the Matanuska Valley, we have a red flag warning for strong winds that are out of the Nick River Valley, which could cause fire to spread rapidly should it start.
Rogers says there's also high fire danger on the Kenai Peninsula. Lightning is predicted in some remote areas, but the biggest concern is human-caused fires in populated areas. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
Unusual weather in Alaska's interior is causing a slowdown of an expected sockeye salmon run on the Copper River. On Wednesday, state fish and game fisheries managers issued a notice delaying the start of the Copper River personal use or dipnet fishery in the Chittenah subdistrict. Mark Somerville is the area management biologist in Glen Allen. He says an unusually late breakup on the Copper and recent soaring temperatures are combining to create conditions that fish don't like.
We had ice cover, shore ice, in the Chittenah subdistrict and just above the bridge in the Glen Allen subdistrict up until about a week ago, and now we've just recently seen a flood situation with increased temperatures, so a lot of ice is moving downriver.
Between May 20th and May 26th, only 26 salmon passed the sonar counter at Miles Lake, closer to Cordova. The prediction for this period is more than 78,000 fish, so the personal use fishery is closed. Somerville says the fish will hold at the mouth of the river until the water warms up.
It appears that we're finally seeing some fish move up the river, but basically looking at temperatures in the river, we're 2 degrees centigrade colder than the average and even some of the lowest lows we've seen, so which is significant when the temperature at this time of year is usually 5 degrees or 4 degrees centigrade. We're looking at temperatures of 2 or less.
Somerville says this year is the first for the record books.
We've never been this far behind on the sonar count and since we've had a sonar going. You know, talking to people that have lived in this area for their entire lives, this is the latest we've seen a breakup and shore ice and these kinds of conditions that we've been seeing.
The personal use fishery at Chittenah will be closed through June 9th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alaska's congressional delegation has expressed outrage over the requirement that timber communities pay back a chunk of their secure rural school subsidies as part of sequestration. But in the affected areas, there's a mood of anxiety as towns worry about what the move signals for the future. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
When Steve Giesbrecht first learned that the federal government was asking Petersburg to return $55,000 in secure rural schools funding, he was a little taken aback.
Confused, that's a good word. Surprised. I mean, it's, you know, especially considering that the money we received is for 2012. How can that be done?
Giesbrecht is the borough manager in Petersburg, one of the biggest recipients of secure rural schools money in Alaska. The borough got over $1 million last year, with most of it going to education and the rest going to infrastructure projects. Giesbrecht says that Petersburg got the funds months ago and that they've all been allocated already. He's hoping that they don't have to pay the money back for that reason, and Governor Sean Parnell has already said that Alaska has no plans to return the money that the federal government says that it owes. But Giesbrecht says Petersburg could scrounge up the funds if it needed to, and that he's more worried about what the repayment request means for the program's future.
55 is painful, and we would have to figure out a way to do that. It's the long term, it's the bigger issue.
The Secure Rural Schools program was started as a way to compensate timber communities for prohibitions on logging in national forest lands. With the federal government focused on tightening the budget, Giesbrecht and city officials from places like Juneau and Wrangell are worried that the program is at risk. He says that if the money were to go away, it would be like a house of cards, because Petersburg can only collect so much in property tax from its small population base.
So it becomes not a government issue as much as it does a community issue, in the sense that we have to find out, all right, now how do we make that up? How do we decide what services we can still afford to offer, and both at the school and within the borough.
Communities in Southeast spread across the Tongass National Forest got over $10 million in secure rural schools funding this past year, while the South Central region got nearly $4 million for Chugach National Forest lands. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Tesoro Corporation has been issued a fine of more than $1 million for violating provisions of the Clean Air Act. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran explains.
In 2011, the Environmental Protection Agency filed a complaint that Tesoro wasn't properly testing and keeping records of its conventional gasoline products. This was happening at a handful of refineries in the western U.S., including the one in Kenai. On Thursday, the EPA announced an agreement with Tesoro. The company will pay a $1.1 million fine and revamp its procedures for testing and reporting fuels. Tesoro spokesperson Matt Gill says the records in question date back to 2003.
It has more to do with testing protocols, paperwork, what got filled out, what boxes got checked, and where the samples were taken from our tanks, whether it was, samples taken on the top and the bottom instead of at three or four points that the EPA would have preferred. At the end of the day, we believe that all the fuel that went out complied with regulations, just maybe not in the manner that they wanted it tested.
EPA officials handling this case in Washington, D.C. couldn't be reached in time for this story, but in a press release Thursday, the agency said that by taking action against violations of these regulations, the agency is protecting people's health and ensuring a level playing field for refiners that play by the rules. Based on the consent decree handed down by the D.C. District Court, Tesoro must preserve all documents and records of its fuel tests for 2 years. The EPA can ask for samples from Tesoro at any time. Gill says the company has already started working with EPA to clean up its testing protocol.
You see this and it makes you wonder about, like you said, quality of your fuels and what's going on to the environment. And we take this very seriously, and we certainly don't feel that any of our products that have gone out have been anything less than what people would expect.
Tesoro will also prepare and implement a system-wide compliance plan and provide EPA with all of that paperwork as it pertains to the Clean Air Act. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
In less than 6 weeks, the Tustamina ferry is supposed to wrap up repairs and set sail to Southwest Alaska, but the shipyard says that delivery date is not looking realistic. As the state faces a blown deadline for getting the Tustamina back into service, they've started looking for other ships to pick up the ferry's route. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, it doesn't have to be a perfect fit.
Seward Ships Dry Dock has been working on the Tustamina for 7 months now, and at every turn they've uncovered previously unknown problems with the steelwork, the computer systems, and now the propulsion controls. The shipyard's general manager, Pinkney Cunningham, wouldn't talk about the Tustamina on tape, but he says his crews are still finding new work to do on the ferry. Cunningham knows the Tustamina is scheduled to go back into service July 7th. When asked if that's realistic, he says, quote, "It might be a stretch." The Department of Transportation says they're still counting on the Tustamina for July sailings, but just in case, they've put out what's called a request for information for vessels that could fill in this summer. They want anyone who has a Coast Guard certified ship that can carry at least 3 cars and 6 people to get in touch. DOT spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the request for alternate vessels isn't a judgment on whether the Tustie will be ready on time. He describes it as a response to lobbying from a port community.
The work right now is continuing as progressed, but the City of Kodiak Chamber of Commerce actually sent a letter to the Marine Highway System requesting that we find an alternative just in case that we aren't able to return to service as expected.
Trevor Brown runs the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce. He says he was pleasantly surprised to find that the state did what the chamber asked.
Kodiak Chamber does applaud the Alaska Marine Highway for taking steps to identify some alternative transportation services. It looks like just for Kodiak and Kodiak communities.
Brown is right. The DOT put down Kodiak, Old Harbor, Yuzinki, Port Lions, and then Homer as required ports of call. That leaves out a major part of the Tustie's route, the Aleutian Chain. Woodrow says it's not included because it will be hard enough to find a vessel that can serve Kodiak.
We figured we'd try to, at least see what's out there for Kodiak, and then second, see if that can be also applied to the chain communities.
Brown, with the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce, says they never intended to leave anyone out.
We don't want to eliminate any of the chain runs. Everybody to the west of us are all kind of in the same boat on this one.
The DOT's request for other vessels to serve the route is open through June 5th. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Walsh. Aldrin. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.